I'm Andrew O'Hagan, host of a new podcast from the London Review of Books. It's about the bloodiest and most controversial event of the Falklands War, the sinking of the General Belgrano. Margaret Thatcher was accused of a war crime. The truth would only emerge in the pages of a private diary. This is the Belgrano Diary. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
Welcome to the London Review Bookshop podcast. To find out about our upcoming events, visit londonreviewbookshop.co.uk/events.
I'm thinking about how to kick off with such a diverse spread of interests. And there are quite a few things, looking back over your work, that I thought you might consider yourself to be sharing. You both have an interest in French politics and culture, an interest in war, post-colonialism, colonialism itself, and with what Jeremy has called an informed worry about the Middle East.
Yeah.
And you're often uncovering the politics beneath literature or the political motivation of an artist with your piece and exploring the politics of the act of creation as well as the politics of the situation that it describes. Mm. I'm thinking of the pieces you've done about writers and theatre and theatre practitioners. Do you feel a strong sense of responsibility when writing that kind of piece to navigate that maze for the reader? How much of a responsibility do you feel to communicate the work as well as the politics of the situation?
I feel it's the same as any other contributor, and that what you really want to do is to kind of draw the reader into a world where the maximum information is available without overloading the detail. And if you're talking about a writer who's, or a creator who's enmeshed in a difficult political situation, you've obviously got to give it your best shot to try and account for what the context and the world in which that writing unfolds is. You have to kind of give a generous account of it for the reader, let alone try to do the writer in question justice. I did do this piece in Lebanon in 2006 as the Israelis had pulled out after a very violent incursion into Lebanon, and actually they were on the back foot as they left, but when I went to meet the author Elias Khoury, who produced to me this astonishing novel Gate of the Sun, which was a kind of account of the Palestinian Nakba done in the most complicated and compelling way, I felt that I had to get Elias Khoury into position to show me what Lebanon was going through as a result of Israel's behaviour in the region. So he took me right down to Hezbollah, and he knew them all, and we went down in the south where the place had been actually ravaged, gave me a range of thoughts about that, brought me back up. I was able to situate the novel in terms of not only what I'd seen myself and my own conversations with Hezbollah and the people living in the south, but also with his view of the whole thing. So actually to try and give the reader that whole scope, that's what you're up to in that situation. So yes, to take a passage through the maze or bring it all together.
Mm. I mean, with the piece about Giuliano Merchamis, I was writing about someone who... unlike Elias, was dead, and
you should explain who
in
he
a
was.
Sense, right? I mean, and who in some way had 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 died because of the extremity of his own imagination. Giuliano Merchamis was an actor and a theater director, activist, the son of an Israeli Jewish woman who had been in the Communist Party and who, after Israel's the War of Independence and the Nakba, had married a Palestinian Christian man who had also been in the political party, in the Communist Party. And Giuliano said that he was 100% Jewish and 100% Arab. And he became a prominent actor in Israeli cinema, but was always kind of on the fault line of Israeli and Palestinian, Arab and Jewish. And his mother, Arna Mayer, went on to found this extraordinary school for the arts in the Jenin refugee camp. And her her students were raised during the First Intifada, and they were teenagers. They were 10, 12, and teenagers, and they went on to become militants in the Second Intifada. Giuliano, after his mother's death, went back to Jenin and filmed her students, now who are now fighters in the Jenin refugee camp, and made this incredible film, very powerful film, which I think you can see on YouTube, called Arna's Children. And a few years after the film appeared, he created a school in her honor in the Jenin refugee camp, and where he trained Palestinian artists and actors. Then in 2011, Giuliano was murdered outside of the theater. And I arrived actually in Jenin a couple of months after he was killed. The murder hadn't been solved, and then I returned a couple of years later to do a reported piece on why Giuliano had died. He had had two missions, intertwined missions at the camp. One was to confront the Israeli occupation with what he called cultural resistance, and the other was to confront what he called the cultural occupation, the occupation of Palestinian cultural life by religious conservatism, and this placed him in increasingly difficult and precarious circumstances, because although he considered himself 100% Arab Palestinian, he was an outsider in the Jenin refugee camp and was viewed with some degree of suspicion by people who had power in the camp. So what I found fascinating about the story of Giuliano is that it was an attempt to use the imagination to launch a kind of cultural revolution under circumstances of occupation. And I think that what happened to Giuliano was in some ways a parable of the limitations of such a project. And it was a project that attracted a lot of well-meaning progressives from around the world, and there were a lot of hope was invested in that project. And it was very noble, but it was also perhaps dangerous. And I think that connection between audacity, the imagination, daring, and danger was intriguing to me.
Did you change your mind about him once you went there? It's a kind of mystery, that mystery story, that article, isn't it? Because he predicted his death.
Well,
before it happened.
He did on YouTube. I still had a lot of admiration for Giuliano, and I think that political change, transformative political change, for the most part, only happens because of people like that, because of people who are willing to cross a boundary and to take real risks. But at the same time, I think that I became disillusioned with the view of Giuliano as just the heartthrob of the radical left, and saw him as a person who was also driven by ego, and who did not always have great respect for local cultural norms.
Yeah, it's a very nuanced portrait of him. And I think that, would you say that that's a characteristic of the newspaper? You don't, or the publication, you don't go for a straightforward hagiography, usually. There are all kinds of ins and outs.
Nothing if not nuanced.
What happens if you change your mind during the investigation of a subject or a situation? You do that on the ground, I guess.
You do that on the ground, you do it in the piece, don't you? I mean, I don't think there's a lot of difference in that sense, intellectually, in terms of the demand of a subject. Whether it's a piece of reportage and you're bringing back material and considering it, or whether you're looking at a book that you just have to get to grips with and you've got a range of thoughts about it, and you throw those in the air and you put them on paper and maybe they don't add up, and you know, there's this sort of argumentative process that applies as much in trying to figure out what it was you saw as a reporter as it does when you're trying to get to grips with what a writer thinks and whether you think what they think is any good.
I'm thinking in particular, you mentioned Kosovo already, and...
Yeah, I did go to Kosovo 3 times, actually, I found myself favouring the intervention, you know, by a whisker, really. And it was another extraordinary piece of generosity on the part of the editors. I felt very strongly that the editors, rightly and with very coherent arguments, did not favour the intervention. And I could see exactly why. But after 3 stints on the ground, I began to change my mind about this. And although my view of the intervention was kind of inflected, I wasn't gung-ho for it, it was nonetheless not a popular view. They had absolutely no problem running what I said. You know, they had a kind of a line. We had a kind of a line in the office. But it was possible for a writer to cross that line and disagree with it and risk a certain unpopularity, you know, on the part of the readers.
And in that sense, you've already touched upon the idea that you have felt privileged to be in the space of the newspaper. Do you consider it a British publication? It's got a very international element to it.
I think it would be quite good to ask somebody who lives in the US about that.
So do I.
To me, it seemed often extremely British.
when I
worked in the office.
Go on, tell us.
It's funny, before I got here, I was thinking of the that Sting song, An Englishman in New York. And I thought, well, I was the American in London. So I think that I would have felt it much more, perhaps more strongly than the Jeremy. But I just want to go back briefly to the question that you posed earlier about the nature of LRB writing, and what strikes me about the Jeremy's writing, for example, and Jeremy's writing influenced me a great deal, is the unsettled probing quality, the curiosity, the struggle to reach a conclusion, and then I think that often articles in some of the rival publications have been about reaching a definitive viewpoint, settling an argument, and that's rarely the case with LRB pieces. The purpose of LRB pieces, for the most part, has been to open up a subject and to own up to certain ambivalences, unsettled spaces, and ambiguities. And I think that often makes the writing much richer. There's a deeper level of curiosity. I used to read Jeremy's pieces. I wasn't always able to follow them because in a good sense, because there was something kind of mysterious about them. They were political pieces, and yet they had strong poetic inflections, and I had to read them several times sometimes to really follow him to the end of his argument. But I think that's because he was really struggling in those pieces, and it made a very powerful impression on me.
I do like the idea that writers should struggle with what their material is in front of the reader. I do think it's okay to kind of, to be seen to be sweating a bit with one's material. I think it's okay. I was also going to say that, you know, that this kind of richness and willingness to kind of get to grips with subjects, I mean, we're by no means the only paper that does this kind of thing. The world is full of, luckily, some really classy writers who go about this thing in the way that I'd aspire to go about it. But I do think that the question of not equivocation but ambivalence is something that the LRB has made a very good habit of. And that, to my view, has to do with the editor, to do with Mary Kay Wilmers, and the fact that she doesn't like things to be settled easily or in a trice or wrapped up and put away. So she would rather look at a piece and say to you, yeah, I see what it is that you're on about, but actually, I think you should try and kind of move some of these thoughts forward a bit and question what it was that you'd originally handed me as a piece of copy, and we'll have a look at it once you've done that. And you do, once you've gone back and thought, oh, okay, she's not entirely clear about whether that's a dead certainty as I assumed it to be. You do, as you start to look into what you said, begin to reflect and maybe think, yeah, but there's another angle to this. And can I do that without creating mush in prose? And that's, I think, what she does with her writers very well, is to get them to allow them to have a second thought, but not to turn the piece into mush. And that's a really, I'm really grateful to be edited in that way. Not that it's always easy.
Yeah, what's the process like? How does the back and forth work?
It's very tiresome, actually. It's seriously tiresome.
Does it happen on email, person?
all kinds of ways.
How many rounds in the ring are there?
Well, it depends how it goes. I mean, some pieces seem to go through fine. Others go through several iterations and, you know, you're left kind of feeling a bit sort of flat on the floor, but actually the results are normally better than you'd expected.
I think in the case of the Egypt piece that I mentioned, I seem to recall storming out of the office almost in tears over the first edit.
Right.
And yet ultimately I had to acknowledge the wisdom of that editorial judgment. I mean, I sound almost like a member of the Communist Party who ultimately has to acknowledge that the party is always right in the end.
Yeah, but we are all in the party, actually.
But usually, almost invariably, the editors, I think, are very sound in their judgments about the shape of the piece and how it should develop. And you know, you benefit enormously from that kind of guidance.
And I'd also want to say that, you know, as a victim of editing, one isn't simply at the mercy of Mary Kay. You have a whole range of there's a sort of Politburo-like thing, which is, and by which I mean everybody has a view, and the views and the collective focus on your piece is actually unbelievably flattering in some way. It feels really very, very good to have several editors looking at it and telling you where they think you might have slipped up. And the best thing about that is that you feel held. You can go out on a limb in your early drafts and take a few chances, and maybe they work or maybe they don't. But in the end, your piece will be kind of rocked into position, not just by the editor, but by her colleagues, who are also our colleagues. And this is the most, you know, touching thing about working for the paper, I feel very guarded and protected, and even if I say quite extreme things, that actually it's been screened. There may be technical mistakes or factuals cropping up here or there, but by and large, I've been helped to get the tone into position, and I think that's amazing.
Mm-hmm. Is it ever dangerous to show the struggle and the workings on the page? I'm thinking about the piece on the Allenby crossing.
Yeah.
Where you mentioned that the number of deaths in the crossing light up on an image and could be mistaken for lumpfish caviar.
Yeah.
I found that very moving when I read it, and it's part of the power of the piece. But I sense that there's an emotion at play when you write about migration and the uninvited.
I think you've got to... I feel I've got to go for... If a notion like that kind of crosses one's mind, I think one's got to go for it, and then you've got this kind of editorial taste that will tell you whether you've kind of you've done something transgressive or offensive. But I was talking about what had happened after the 67 war, and how the expulsions after the expulsions actually. Palestinians started trying to come back across the River Jordan, and including fighters. And the Israelis took up their positions and created a loss of life as people were coming back. Sometimes there are images which you just have to take a chance with, and you don't want to be vulgar, and you don't want to be transgressive. Is that your question?
Yeah.
But you don't.
But also something about how it betrays you, the writer.
Yeah. Well, you don't want to overinvest. It's difficult. It's a question of judgment, because you don't want to. You want to keep the material, roughly speaking, clear. But of course, sometimes you see something that is so shockingly apparent that maybe you should say it.
Well, I think the great thing about the paper, when it comes to subjects like Israel-Palestine, since you just mentioned it, is that you're very much allowed to encourage to have a point of view, but you're discouraged from being pious.
Correct.
And so your point of view is reflected through the reporting, through the stories that you tell, through the facts that you foreground. But the editors are allergic, and rightly allergic, to cliches, to gestures of sanctimony, you're never going to see references to women and children in the London Review, for example. And I think that's what makes the reporting, which is opinionated, so powerful. It is averse to that kind of cliche.
I mean, there's this other process too, which is the kind of the ferocity of the letters page. So that actually, you have to brace when the paper's carried a piece. Because it's you, the readers, who kind of come back with drastic critiques of what it is that once tried to spell out and maybe got completely wrong. I think the letters page is a wonderful kind of it's a wonderful corrective to what might sound, as Adam and I have been talking for the last half hour, as a slightly self-regarding process. We don't mean it to sound like that at all. We were trying to talk about the inner workings of the paper, but actually, there are so many sort of harsh eyes and intellects out there who are ready to take you on. So you're never quite at rest with the letters page.
Actually, I think evokes a wider world. Than you would see, for example, in the letters page of the New York Review, which does feel like a conversation among contributors. You know, the cliche of the New York Review of each other's books. In the London Review of books, the letters page, you're going to see names that you've never seen before. Yeah. They're just from informed people who read the paper, but who are not themselves published writers or contributors to the paper.
And they're coming at you and saying they're making really pertinent thought points that might not have crossed your mind, or they're pointing out things that you simply hadn't understood.
Have you ever been hurt by a letter, or enraged or hurt? Do you allow yourself those emotions?
I like it that readers kind of come in and want to kind of have an argument with you. After all, to the extent that we're published in the paper, we're on the we're on this kind of platform, aren't we? And the possibility of other people mounting the platform and saying, no, I just think you've got that all wrong, I think is great. So you shouldn't really be hurt. You can be really, really, really embarrassed when you've got something wrong. Every journalist gets something wrong sooner or later, some sort of factual. And it's good that it should be pointed out. But.
It's always good to know that you've struck a nerve, I guess. I did get one. I mean, probably the letter that troubled me the most was one that I received. It was not published in the letters page, but it was a letter prompted by that article about Giuliano Merhamis promising that I would be anally raped if I ever appeared in Jenin again. And then killed.
Oh dear.
But that letter actually was by the son of a woman who very much admired the piece, and apparently he hadn't even read the piece. So that was probably the most intense letter I'd ever received.
So I can't say I've been threatened in the letters page, but
could you tell us a bit about your article on France Fanon? I wanted to touch upon it earlier when we were talking about this idea of not being pious, but representing a very complex portrait of someone who is often revered. There are many different shades of grey in that article. Mm-hmm. What was it like writing it?
That was a really incredible experience. That piece arose out of an anthology published by the Édition de la Découverte, a French publisher, edited by two scholars, and it was a collection of previously uncollected and in some cases unpublished writings that Frantz Fanon, the Martinican psychiatrist who joined the Algerian liberation struggle, had written on, for the most part, on psychiatry. There were also texts, theatrical texts that he'd written when he was a young man. Miscellany, really, but very interesting miscellany that gave, a different image than the kind of the heroic, iconic image of Fanon as a doctor who joined the liberation struggle. I think that, you know, here was someone who had been seen as just kind of a mascot, as a third world liberation figure, and here you saw someone who was really a profound thinker and philosopher, and someone who
And a practicing
psychiatrist who was working through the ideas of Ferenczi on war trauma and Lacan, the mirror phase, and so I think I spent 7 or 8 months reading this enormous anthology. It was, I think, about 1,000 pages long, and returning to a figure who had always been important to me. I'd actually written about him, I think 15 or so years earlier, for the New York Times book review. So it was a real journey in a way.
It is actually a really amazing piece because you see Fanon going into this colonial... It's very striking. Fanon going in as a qualified medic into this French colonial hospital, mental hospital, where there's something like 187 patients, or 182, I've forgotten, and half of them are chained, they're tied to beds or tied to trees in the ground. And he's looking at this and saying, but what's going on here? You know, I mean, have enlightened psychiatry in the metropole and completely unenlightened colonial sort of slave psychiatry in the colony.
He was applying ideas that he'd learned about in the late 1940s, early 1950s at a psychiatric center called Saint-Alban, directed by a resistance psychiatrist, François Tosquelles, who had organized the psychiatric services of the Spanish Republican Army. And he was deeply influenced by Toscaeus's practice and wanted to apply those ideas elsewhere. I think that, you know, what hadn't really been properly understood by a lot of people is that Fanon went to Algeria as a representative of the French colonial administration. Yeah. He didn't go there as a liberation fighter. He was aware of the colonial context and it actually had written about Algerians in France, but he went there just to practice psychiatry, and it was in practicing psychiatry that he was revolutionized because he realized that he could not effectively practice it under these conditions of extreme violence and oppression.
Well, before I open it out to the floor, one last question for us. What do you think are the challenges facing the London Review of Books right now? You've both been writing for the publication for so many years. You must have seen it through many different curves and ups and downs. What are the big things that need tackling for you right now?
I think that's something that's going to come up in when we extend the conversation, but something that strikes me looking back is that when I began writing for the paper right up through the 1990s, I did a lot of work on colonial Africa. And when I say colonial, I mean struggles that were still going on after most of Africa had been decolonized in the 60s. To run through it again, it's Western Sahara, Namibia, South Africa, Angola, Mozambique, where there had been technical liberation, but actually the forces of colonialism were on their case and determined to stop it in Angola and Mozambique. And I felt, as a younger person then, totally free to write about these subjects unfolding in a distant continent. And the key question there being that these were colonial matters, or ex-colonial, or rather unsolved colonial matters. I had no problem with that, because actually my background, if I had any political background, it was sort of latterly during the end of the 70s and early 80s in the international solidarity movements, you know, against apartheid, in favour of Mozambique and Angola, for the Palestinians and one thing or another. So it struck me as absolutely not a contradiction that I was a white British man covering these stories. It seemed to me a completely coherent and fluent process. And also the solidarity movements were full here in Britain of people like me. I mean, white English people. If they hadn't been it, they wouldn't have worked. And so I think the challenge, if I want to frame it like that, is to reconsider and reimagine a writer for the LRB covering similar sorts of stories wherever they might arise, and thinking, but who would that writer be? Would that writer have the same kind of curriculum vitae, the same kind of complexion, the same kind of British disposition as I had? Or would that writer be someone you'd be looking for from actually another space, including, in the case of writing about Africa, writers who were actually in Africa? And I think this is one of the big challenges the paper will have to kind of figure out in the years to come. So that would be one of them.
What about you, Adam?
I would agree. My experience was different, because when I was writing from, let's say, from the West Bank, or for that matter, from Algeria or Lebanon or Egypt, I think that I experienced my identity not as a white man, really, but as someone who was a, you know, let's say a non-Jewish Jew, right? whose Jewishness was suddenly actually rather important in certain contexts.
Sure.
But I couldn't agree with you more that one of the challenges for the LRB in the not just the future but the present, the immediate future, is the discovery of new voices and expanding the ranks of LRB writers to include people who are reflective of the complex reality of our societies, and to move beyond a certain coterie. And I think that's happening. Mm-hmm.
Jeremy, when you look back on those struggles that you felt so fluently part of, Why do you think you said that they wouldn't have worked if people like you weren't involved? Could you unpack that a little bit?
Oh, sorry. All I meant, yes, not the struggles themselves, but the solidarity campaigns, where we used to be asked to do things like, you know, write stuff, petition MPs, and kind of keep these places alive in British culture. There simply wouldn't have been enough people to do it if it had been confined to minorities or actually exiles from sub-Saharan African struggles. And London was full of them, actually, during the 70s and 80s and 90s. You know, if you went to the Africa Centre, you could meet a whole range of people who'd been slung out by regimes. But they were not in themselves sufficient to constitute big solidarity movements against apartheid, against the kind of harassment of Angola and Mozambique, you know, or against the Moroccan colonization of Western Sahara. You needed British indigenous people to rally to those causes. And actually, the anti-apartheid movement here, I'm sure I don't have to tell you, was pretty impressive. There were many, many people working against apartheid in however modest a way.
So it is about spheres of influence.
Yes.
Is an interesting
idea
for what you're talking about, which is how you go forward, how the LRB goes forward, because it's also about those spheres of influence, isn't it?
I think it is, and it's also about the way that the world is shifting, and, you know, the Global South is so much more present in our lives and in our spaces, in our northern spaces, that we have to completely reconceive this. It's already happening. It's just that we have to kind of describe it to ourselves and get hold of what's going on.
Okay. Well, that was really great. And if we can open it out to questions, that would be wonderful. Do we have a mic that's moving? Great. So any questions? Right at the back there, hand up.
As writers as editors, editorial staff, and writers who feel that they've been able to write against the grain sometimes of the paper and have been and have done that comfortably. I mean, I'm very struck, say, by the presence or the continued presence of Christopher Hitchens on the LRB, as an LRB contributor after his turn, as it were, and the presence of somebody like Rory Stewart. Very sort of culturally LRB people, as it were, and yet their politics are very, very at odds with the editorial line at various times. I wonder, are there any tensions that you're able to tell us about? Any tensions that have come up with those sorts of figures, with their recruitment and their retention and with in communication with them?
Yeah, yes, I could talk a little bit about that. I mean, Hitchens is a very good case because the Hitchens problem arose slightly before the turn in 2003 because the paper wasn't really happy. And by the paper, I mean Mary Kay and Jean McNichol, the deputy editor. And I think I'm right in the date would be, yes, and Carl Miller. We're not entirely happy with the way Bosnia was being described. And Hitchens was very much in favour of an intervention in Bosnia. And there was trouble about that position. And we didn't entirely like it. I say we, but I wasn't actually a member of the editorial board, the editors at that point. And so those kinds of cracklings in the air in the office, they often arose. We also had a range of interesting Tories during the Thatcher era, Ian Gilmore in particular. We liked Ian Gilmore because he was capable of explaining just what the difficulty of the Palestinians was and how intractable it seemed to be becoming year by year. But Gilmore was a Tory. He was an anti-Thatcherite, but nevertheless a Tory. Rory Stewart is another example of someone who we feel is a sufficiently interesting writer to publish, and we argue about. It's this kind of thing that, you know, we might sulk about to and fro between ourselves and about whether it gets in or whether it doesn't. But there's constant kind of conversation, occasional bad temper. But that's what happens in a collective process. And we do have all these oddities or outliers who are still with us. And to me, that's a good thing.
What about you, Adam? Do you feel that difference in representation of you, the exceptions are important to prove the rule?
I mean, I think that's what makes the London Review of Books lively, that it doesn't have a line. Obviously, there are some things that we feel passionate about and where you're going to find more consensus than on some other issues. But, you know, the LRB team is a collection of people who are very iconoclastic, very different from one another. And I think that there are people who don't feel, who are not particularly comfortable in situations of absolute consensus. I think they find it, for the most part, they find it boring. I think the paper draws a lot of strength from that.
He's right.
From that, I mean, at the risk of the risk of saying something for which Nikita would rightly ridicule me at dinner later on. I do think that, you know, to be a writer or an intellectual, in some ways, to be out of sync, you know, to be in a position of dissent, discomfort, at an angle, and I think that defines most of the people who write for the London Review of Books. So absolute agreement is actually pretty rare, I would say. Yeah. There's a lot of discussion, a lot of contention in the office, but ultimately I think what matters is the piece interesting? Is it persuasive on its own terms? Does it push the discussion in some way? And so for that reason, we do publish people who... are not comfortably left liberal or radical, for that matter. Another example would be someone like Ferdinand Mount, right? Who I think is one of the paper's most brilliant writers, and he's hardly someone with whom I would agree on any number of issues. But I, you know, really admire his prose.
So you could put the editors together as they are inevitably. In a room and have the odd spat, more than the odd spat, and the odd disagreement. But you certainly couldn't bring all the contributors together, some of whom are here in this room, and sit them down for a day and expect them to get along, because there's chalk and cheese in there. There's no question about it. And that, I mean, I find that it's a kind of quickening thing for me. That's what I like about it.
Thank you. I want to ask you talked about the letters page and the influence of the letters page. The letters page is still a mediated space. The reality of today's journalism and communication is the great expansion of unmediated comment and criticism through. And the tweets are the very opposite of what the London Review of Books stands for. I think you can't have a 32,000 word tweet.
Take a long time.
I just wonder how you react to this new reality, new technical reality in the world of publishing.
I'm not really equipped to talk about that because I'm not on Twitter. But Adam, can you talk about that? I mean, we are in that world. There's no question about it. The one thing I could say about that is that the letters pages are really... nice in that way, that they're still granular and they're going away from highly condensed kinds of discourse. But I do think there's really, when I go onto Twitter, because I have to, I also see very, very interesting things happening there. Quite fascinating stuff being said. But could you talk a bit more about social media?
Well, I'm on hiatus from Twitter at the moment after reading Richard Seymour's book, The Twittering Machine. I think that there are certain styles of rhetoric on Twitter that are really very much opposed to what the LRB does. I mean, particularly things like virtue signaling and naming and shaming that in my view are just antithetical to what the LRB is about. Because even when the LRB is in a politically campaigning mode, and we are sometimes about issues that, you know, we really care very passionately about. I still think that our purpose is to refresh the imagination, to intensify curiosity, certainly to identify perpetrators of crimes, but not for the sake of feeling kind of better about ourselves. And I do think that a lot of the discussion on Twitter tends towards that.
Have you ever caused a Twitter storm then? Did you ever deliberately...
He is a Twitter
drop
storm.
Drop something provocative.
A one-man Twitter storm.
And walk away.
No.
No.
I want to ask you a question about a journalist relationship with a situation where there's military operation going on. I read your article many years ago about your experience in Kuta Kinabalu in Angola, where you were ordered to leave the area,
yeah,
and you were reporting something. How did you feel? Because I can give you an example of a situation which I experienced, reactions from a set of journalists from Britain, BBC, American, CBS, and so forth. When I was at a Polisario camp in Tindouf in Algeria.
In 1987.
That's it.
I know your face. I can't recognize it. Yeah.
I was in a tent with my wife. Yeah. And we were
there.
Was I? I was there.
We were sharing this tent.
Yes.
And there were these journalists who started protesting because in the middle of the night, the soldiers came in, the Polisario soldiers, and told them to get on this 135 Hercules plane that was waiting there. Because there was going to be a sandstorm, and they would be stuck there for about 7 days.
Yep.
And they were outrageous about it because they started calling them all kinds
KGB.
Of KGB, Gestapo, and all that. But you showed a different face in Angola.
Can I just say something about this episode in Western Sahara? There was the most terrible sandstorm that followed.
Yeah.
And these journalists, who didn't have a lot of time, were evacuated by the Polisario for their own good. And the Polisario said, you know, hell is about to break loose over this camp, and this sandstorm is going to go on for 3 days. And I don't think the hacks believed it. They thought, oh, no, there's something up here. They want to hide something from us. Actually, when they'd gone, it was disaster. You couldn't walk 3 yards. In 1990, I still had sand in my wallet. You know, in between my kind of scratched, expired credit cards from that. The thing about Angola was we had to get out because we were told that I was with the army, I wasn't really with commissars of the Angolan government. I and my party of journalists had to go because we were under fire and there were casualties, and I was very, very happy to get out. But we were allowed to see as much as we could. And that's a great thing of some of those places, that even though the regimes were... they were liberation regimes with the usual kinds of strictures that they imposed both on their followers and their peoples and their guests, you actually, if you were patient, had a lot of leeway. And I felt that I had a lot of leeway. The only place I didn't really was in Angola, because that was a serious regime and it was fighting a very, very serious war. Mm. And there were 55,000 Cubans there and they weren't going to mess around. If they wanted to get you out of there somewhere, they would get you out of there. If they didn't want to take you, they wouldn't take you. But we got to Kuita Kinabalu because they said this is going to be historically a decisive battle in southern Africa where you're going to see apartheid go under. It won't be visible now, although we're talking about it, but in years to come, you see that the combination of the military effort and the diplomatic effort swung it away from the possibility of apartheid protracting its time in southern Africa. And they were right, because they'd won a victory there. But when they took us down there, of course, the South Africans hadn't gone, and they were very, very happy to shell us. And so we were told to leave, and we did.
I mentioned one or two of the controversies
I'm thinking perhaps of Hugh Robertson's piece on Gaddafi. Why did Gaddafi have to go? And also the Mearsheimer and Malt piece.
What specifically about those controversies?
Well, they sort of hit the
they did.
Front pages.
They did.
In many respects. Mm. And, sorry, I was going to say they hit the front pages of the national press in this country, right. Both those pieces.
Well, the Mearsheimer-Wald piece has an interesting history because John Mearsheimer and Steve Walt's article about the Israel lobby was originally commissioned by the Atlantic magazine, and the Atlantic magazine refused to publish it, even though John Mearsheimer and Stephen Walt were two highly respected political scientists, one at University of Chicago and the other at Harvard. And it was, I believe that it was Perry Anderson who learned about this article and read it and then presented it to Mary Kay Wilmers and the editorial team at the London Review and, you know, explained its significance. And the LRB, of course, ended up publishing it to great excitement and some fury, and I have my own disagreements with some of the arguments that Walt and Mearsheimer made, but I think that they also made a really important contribution to understanding the phenomena of the way that pro-Israel organizations organize and the way that they shape and constrain public debate in the United States. I think that partly thanks to that article, there's much greater space in the United States for discussing organizations like AIPAC. Hugh Roberts is a rather different instance. Hugh Roberts, for those of you who don't know him, is probably the most distinguished authority on Algeria, writing in English. He teaches at Tufts, and I mean his work on Algeria is really pivotal. We asked him to, he wanted to write on Libya, on the NATO war in Libya, and when that article appeared, there was quite a bit of anger. About it, not least among liberal and left-wing Arabs, including friends of mine, who felt that the article was not sufficiently critical of the Gaddafi regime and that it failed to show sufficient empathy for the Libyan rebellion against the regime. I'm going to put that to one side. I mean, it's a complicated discussion, but what I will say is that Roberts' critique of the NATO operation and of its consequences, I think to some degree, has been vindicated. And some of those who were outraged by Hugh's arguments have been forced to concede that Hugh understood what the implications of the NATO attack might be. And Hugh, of course, is coming from a very Algerianist background. I think he was very influenced by the analysis that the Algerians had of the situation in Libya. The Algerians knew Libya better than really anyone else in North Africa. And in fact, Bouteflika, Abdelaziz Bouteflika, who was the president of Algeria, had a meeting with the American ambassador in Algiers at the time and told him exactly what would happen if Gaddafi was removed from power. I think he was very much informed by his Algerian context. So it was a real risk for the paper to run a piece like that. And of course, the title was provocative. LRB titles often have an insouciant quality. And I think if you judge the piece purely on the basis of the title, you know, who said Gaddafi had to go, then you would reach a very crude understanding of what that article was about. I mean, we're talking about a, I think, a 15 or 18,000 word article that was deeply immersed in Libyan history and the relationship between East and West. And I mean, an article that I you know, can't begin to summarize here. The title was perhaps a little too playful, but I think that that article actually reread today will seem, in my view, seems very, very prescient.
But it's an interesting moment when you feel you've got yourself into trouble. I mean, is that part of your question?
Yeah, I think it's also, I felt at the time it was important because of the calamity over Iraq, you know, the sectarian bloodbath that followed intervention there. Yet here we were again with Sarko and Cameron.
Yeah.
You know, it was hilarious in the background.
Let's not forget Be'ashel.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely.
Bernardi. Whose I just learned that his nickname, James Walcott, in his brilliant review of the new Sontag biography, notes that Be'ashel's nickname in during the Bosnian War was DHS, Deuxheures à Sarajevo.
Any other questions?
Thank you very much. At the risk of offending probably half the room, looking at the next 40 years, what should the LRB do to better engage younger people?
More than half the room, mate. This is a question for you guys.
Do you mean engage them as readers?
As readers.
Keep looking for writers. Your question being that, or your feeling being that really the age group is sort of, is kind of a little bit... kind of crinkly.
Okay. Between 20.
You know, I wonder about that though. Whether I mean, because I, you know, I look at, you know, I'm have some familiarity with the, you know, the New York Review's office culture compared to the London Review of Books, and one of the things that strikes me about the way the LRB operates as an institution is that it has always empowered young people who work there, very much in contrast with the New York Review during the Bob Silvers era, when young people worked for Silvers without really being encouraged at all, having very little autonomy, feeling suffocated in many ways. If you go into the LRB office, you're going to see a lot of people who are, you know, in their, you know, late 20s to mid 30s who are given, you know, enormous leeway and who, you know, are, you know, publishing, you know, really important pieces and who are shaping the contents of the magazine. And I think that, you know, when I when you posed the question, I thought, well, I'm actually not so worried about the London Review of Books because I see these young people working in the office who are passionate, literary, engaged with the world, interested in art and politics, and I think they are going to create a new LRB that young people are going to be interested in reading. Not all young people, of course, but enough to keep that the LRB alive and well.
So it can't, by definition, be static. And since, also by definition, a lot of the editors who've come on board in the last sort of 7 or 8 years, like young, it has to follow that there will be younger contributors. And I'm pretty sure I know that the average age of the readership has fallen. Yes. Because it used to be people of my age, you know, I mean, across the board, and it's no longer the case. So something is happening.
Do you think that that's is that a tonal change? That means...
Well,
what does
I have
to do with the access online to the articles?
I think the online availability of the paper is a tremendous help to reach a wider readership of all ages, actually. But I don't altogether observe a tonal change, even though I know the paper is evolving. There are things I read which I know it's true I wouldn't have seen in the paper 5 years ago or longer ago. Because of the way I read, and I suppose I read for continuity because I'm that kind of reader, I see something going on that's really consistent, but I may well be wrong about that. There are lurches and changes, and there's interesting writers coming in who I would never have expected to be part of the scene, and I welcome that. And we just have to be patient, you know.
Was there another question here?
Yes, partial question. Have there been any subjects or perhaps figures or topics with which you've been fascinated or obsessed over a very long time, but on which you've never written yet?
That's a good question. I don't think there are. And if there were, and were I to reach into my mind and try and find them, it might turn out that the reason I hadn't written about them was probably because I suspected I'd make a hash of it and get it wrong in some way. I have been allowed to write about things that are kind of off my beat. I mean, there's a couple of occasions where I've written about poets who are very dear to me. And I like doing that, but I wouldn't make a habit of it. But no, I don't think I think most of the ground's been covered, or it's been, or I've walked away from it. And, yeah.
Is it one last question there from the lady at the back? Yeah. Behind. Oh, both of you, I think. So the one behind you first.
I'm going to be a little bit out of sync, along with the writers of the LRB. I know that the topic of this session this evening was to do with very courageous reporting and dreadful events elsewhere in the world. However, I'm here on behalf of a friend of mine who couldn't be here. We are here on her behalf, who wrote a letter, and it was quite ferocious, to the LRB. And I'm speaking because I don't think you will hear this from the media, including the LRB. So that's why I'm speaking now. She wrote this letter, and she received an acknowledgement in July that it would be considered, but it hasn't appeared. Now, I don't know what the timescale of these things are, so that may be quite common. The out-of-syncness is that the letter was about the LRB's coverage of what's happening to Julian Assange. And as we speak, of course, he's incarcerated in Belmarsh. I have a copy. I'm saying this again because I don't know that you would know this.
Can I just
otherwise
interrupt you and ask? Do you have a question? Do you have a question that you could pose? That much time.
I have a copy of the letter, and I am going to give it to the associate editors and the chairperson. I also have some copies if other people want to read it. I also want to say, before I ask my question, that Craig Murray made a shocking, shocking and detailed report of what happened to Julian Assange when he went into the Magistrates' Court, Westminster Magistrates' Court, three or four days ago.
Thanks very much.
So, and I'm just saying, Craig question? Murray, look it up. My question is, why hasn't it been published?
Great, thanks very much.
Okay. I'm not in a position to answer that because I haven't seen the letter. But it can take a very long time for stuff to get published. But I would have thought that if it was a letter that hasn't been published by now, the decision has been not to publish it. As regards articles, we can have them there waiting around for months at a stretch. But I believe that the thing of a letter is that if it's not published within a few months of receipt, then it's gone, basically. Yep.
Could we have the final... Could we have the final question from the person there? Thanks very much.
Thank you so much. In part, my questions were answered, but I was wondering if you could say a bit more about, I'm a great fan, of how much do you think your readers drive the work of the publication? I mean, in part, you've said that, but it's interesting.
Could you say that again? How much do your
How much do you think the readership drives the work of the
drives the work, the, of
drives
the,
work of the publication? And whether, well, this is, I guess, a lot very debated, whether there's a style, there's a literary style. One reads the LRB and one senses that there is not a uniformity of style, but a sort of resonances across the pieces. But what is your...
Jeremy and I were actually talking about that this morning, whether there's an LRB style.
I think all papers have a style, if they're any good. And that style is somewhat forced on them by a kind of... a consensus among editors about how a piece should sound and what the kind of resonance and the kind of weight of argument should be, which is also, by the way, another interesting question about how we get younger, different writers in without feeling that we're somehow breaking our own rules. I think we should begin to feel a little less inhibited about that. But there is that aspect of a kind of package, which is the wrong word, but a way of speaking, a manner of speaking. The writers drive it in this kind of strange triangular way that we writers, or I can speak for myself, I kind of write to an editor. And in writing to an editor, after all these years, I think, that I'm writing to the readership whom that editor represents. There's this kind of agora that is kind of that I have to address, and therefore I feel driven to talk in certain ways to that public. Mm-hmm. So I feel my writing highly defined by a readership. I don't sense them crowding in the room as I'm doing it, but there's no question that they're there. Some of them come forward and can actually work as inhibiting figures. But by and large, the reader is the person that is helping you shape the conversation. So it's a big deal for me. Mm-hmm.
I do think you're writing for some kind of imagined LRB writer, insofar as you can assume a reader of, I think, greater sophistication than a lot of other magazines you write for. I mean, for example, you're never going to see the phrase, you know, Kafka, comma, a Czech Jewish writer who wrote in German. I mean, I think that you can assume that your readers know who Kafka was. And with regard to style, I worked in the LRB office as one of the editors from 2007 to 2011, and I was always struck by the fact that when American writers wrote for the LRB for the first time and tried to approximate what they thought was an LRB mm-hmm. style, the prose was always flowery and often really? Flowery yeah. and ornate. Yeah. Actually, it's the opposite of what LRB writing tends to be. I mean, LRB writing is, I think, has a kind of a real directness and a dislike of excessive, certainly adverbs. That's one thing I hadn't really known that until I got to the office, just how much the paper hated adverbs. Yeah. And then I read the style guide, the book, the master plan. So that combination of, I think, that the directness, but also also an indirectness of argument, an argument that kind of moves in unusual and unexpected directions. But the prose itself, I think, is distinguished by its clarity, its simplicity, the preference for a simple word over a complex or convoluted one. And I learned, Mary Kay Wilmers was, has been not just my editor and employer, but really, frankly, my teacher. I really learned to write by working with her.
And just to add to that, I think that although a paper is always more than the sum of its contributors, they also shape it. For some reason, we don't know how it is that all our various kinds of writing are there together as a kind of team of writers. I'm not talking about the editors, I'm talking about the whole lot, all of us as contributors. We're there, and we give a shape as well. So it's a dialectical thing, really, isn't it? It's a long conversation to and fro, a process between readers, contributors, and editors.
But I do think you have this feeling of being part of what you might call a discursive community.
Yeah,
that you're not just writing for someone out there. You're writing for a community of readers, and I think that it's a wonderful thing to have. Mm. You know that you're writing for people who are actually going to pay attention to your argument, think about it, maybe even write a letter.
And if you can,
whether we'll publish it or not is another question.
but if you can convince yourself on a bad day, if you're.
Why not?
Yeah. Yeah. If you can convince yourself on a bad day that, you know, you're a contributor that really nobody kind of cares about, you can get really pissed off. And I think all contributors do that. Think, oh, we don't belong anymore to this community. But of course we all do. And it's good. It's a stroke of luck.
Thanks very much. And with that, I'd like to thank Jeremy Harding and Adam Chatt.
Thank you. Thank you.
Thanks for listening. To find out more about London Review Bookshop events, visit londonreviewbookshop.co.uk/events.